hopefully bring them up to speed on what the Bible is all about and how it impacts their life and what God is asking of them in the Bible. And so Brother Craig has been really at this for a number of years, and he has come to personally share with us both his experiences, his wisdom and judgment based on what he's seen and heard, other congregations, what works, what doesn't, his own personal experiences. And then, of course, on Sunday, it's kind of a capstone of the weekend, there was in a series of three lessons that are going to be walking us and any visitors we can bring with us through the big picture of the Bible. Brother Craig is not a preacher in terms of how he supports himself. He is a, I guess I could just call you a computer guy. Something like that. Yeah, that's information technology, computers. It's a career that reinvents itself every couple years anyways, right? But his service in the kingdom is truly his passion. He is both made the presentation we're going to have on Sunday, as well as talked about these things around the country and really around the world. He serves the Lord's kingdom locally as one of the elders in the Helena congregation, which is a suburb of Birmingham, Alabama, which is where he calls home. And so we're very thankful that he is here with us for this weekend. At this time, I'm going to ask Brother Anthony Paul to lead us in a word of opening prayer, after which we'll let Brother Craig get to work with us.
Let us pray. Gracious Heavenly Father, we bow before you and we give praise to you, dear Father, give honor to you, for you have done so much for us. You have given us your Son who died in our stead to bring us back to you. You have given us, dear Father, an opportunity to live eternally with you. We thank you so much for that. We ask, dear Father, that you would bless us in this that we are doing tonight, this presentation. Bless Ken as he presents this to us, that he will do an excellent job, dear Father, and we will be further edified to do your will, to teach others the gospel. Please be with us, bless us, and strengthen us is our prayer through Jesus Christ. Amen.
I'm really glad to be here with you tonight, and I want to say to Jeff, of all the introductions I've had through all the years, that introduction tonight was the latest, and I appreciate that. I am thrilled and humbled to be with you tonight, and I do bring you greetings from the Helena Church near Birmingham, where I am, where I'm one of the elders, and I'm really surprised to run into so many people that I know here. Particularly Derek and Karen Bowles, we go way back. They used to worship with us in Birmingham, and it's just a delight to see them. I can't believe they haven't aged a bit, and I have crumbled. And also a lot of my, several of my FC classmates from the class of 72, which I'm told is the greatest class that was ever at FC, and it's good to see them. Of course, you notice Steve Bradley is missing tonight, and Paul Thornton is missing tonight. That should tell you something, because they know me, and I knew they'd come up. Once I found out they were here, I would have bet money they would have found an excuse not to have been here, and they did. And I'm sure a lot of you have been saying, well, who is Ken Craig? Because I'm not a big name preacher. You know, I'm just a big speaker. But one of my objectives, probably being here today and tomorrow, is just to keep Anthony from being fired, because he's the one that asked me to be here. But I'm glad to be with you, and I hope that what I can share with you will be of some profit to you. And let me sort of give you a little background as to why I'm even here. Several years ago, I was on a business trip to Seattle.
The box isn't on.
It was when I put it on here. What does it need to be?
Computer guy. I'm a software guy. This is a hardware problem. I was on a business trip to Seattle, Washington, and the gentleman that was hosting the business trip had a dinner at his house, and I was staying with him. And after dinner, we were just all sitting around talking, a bunch of us, and eventually the conversation I noticed is that they were evangelicals, and they were trying to convince a friend of theirs who was an agnostic of the truth of the Bible and what it all meant and everything. And so we just talked all over the place till around midnight. And I said, look, could I just take a few minutes and kind of explain how this all fits together? And they said, oh, we'd love that. And next thing I know, they brought their 16-year-old son in. They went and woke him up. Brought him in there. And he was a pretty serious-minded fellow. And I just sort of went through an explanation of how the Bible all fit together and everything. And when I finished, the agnostic guy, he said, wow. He said, I never understood that before. Never heard that. And he said, that really makes a lot of sense. And I went, whoa. And I said, well, Robert, I said, I'm just shorting it. I said, but does this change your belief about Jesus Christ, that he is who he said he was? And he thought a minute, and he said, yes, it does. He said, and I'd like to be baptized and have my sins removed. Well, I just about had a heart attack. An agnostic in that short of a time. And then the evangelical couple said, Ken, well, we've never understood that. We've never done that. We need to do that. And then the 16-year-old said, well, I need to do that. And they had a swimming pool in their basement, so at 1 o'clock in the morning, we went down and baptized all of them. And I said, wait a minute, this just sort of rocked my world. What did I say to these guys? If you had asked me prior to that, how would you approach a agnostic? I'd have said, well, you got to start over here and evidences and all this stuff. And how would you do evangelicals? Well, you got to start over here and teach all this stuff over here. If it's a teenager, you got to go this way. But in less than an hour, one message, we're not arguing about the response of faith to the gospel. They're asking me, can they do that? So I sort of asked myself afterwards in retrospect, what did I say to these guys? And that's the approach I started talking, because I realized what I had done is I had shared the gospel with them. And that's not what I had been doing. All of a sudden, I became an evangelism expert. You know, I'm not. And I'll tell you that right up front. I didn't come here because I'm an evangelism expert. I'm going to tell you how to do evangelism. I'm going to help you put a church program in place to do evangelism. Nothing of the kind. But what I'm going to do tomorrow morning is I'm going to share with you that message that I shared with them, and I've shared with hundreds and hundreds of people since then. And hopefully that you may find that it may be something you can use. Now, I started getting asked by churches, well, would you come and tell us about this and all that? So I started doing that and put together a presentation on that. And so I've done these lectures now. I stopped counting at the 200th church. And I've done it in over 20 countries. And I do it anywhere I'm asked, anytime, anywhere. And I haven't lost my job yet because the owner of the company is a Christian. And he enticed me to come and work for him by offering me 6 weeks off a year to go and do evangelism lectures. So that's been very helpful. But you can't help but notice some things. So when I'm around visiting these places, I talk with them about evangelism. And what I want to do with you tonight is just share some observations about evangelism. I don't have any new scriptures or new insight into that. But I just want to talk with you about what I'm seeing out there. And maybe you'll see some things here that are similar, and I'll give you some of my opinions and thoughts about those things. And I'll start here with a story I heard once that kind of reminded me of us. And it was like this little town that sat on the edge of a lake. And one day somebody said, "Hey, you know, there's fish in this lake. If we knew how to fish, we could go out here and catch some fish, and that'd be a great thing." And they said, "Yeah, that'd be a great thing." So the city council got together, and they started talking about fishing, and next thing you knew, they brought some fishing experts in and started studying fishing, and they just talked about it all the time, and they lectured about it, and then pretty soon they got pretty smart, and they were sending out people to talk about fishing and lecture about it and all that. But the problem was no one ever fished. They just didn't, at the end of the day, really do it, but they talked about it a lot. And that's kind of my observation about us and evangelism. We want to do it, and we talk about it, but at the end of the day, we're just not doing it. And I want to talk about some of that tonight. And this fishing analogy, of course, Jesus said, "Come follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." This is a proper analogy or paradigm that the Lord used, and he told us what to fish with. He said, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." The gospel is our bait. That's what we are needing to use. And why this is so important when Christ said that is because of what we learn in Romans 1:16. I'm not ashamed of what? The gospel. For it is the power of God unto salvation. I'll tell you this, we don't believe that. And I didn't believe it. It took me a long time to believe this and understand this. And this is why the gospel is so important. And I'm going to use this passage in 1 Peter 3:15 to sort of capture my thoughts tonight. Because everyone should be able to fish. But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that you have. I contend that every Christian should be able to do this. I don't care if you've been a Christian for 5 minutes. You should be able to give someone the reason for the hope that's within you. If you've been a Christian for 5 years or 50 years, I don't care how old you are, every Christian should be able to do this, and every Christian can do this. So, why aren't we fishing? Why aren't we doing this? And what is it that we're really afraid of? I mean, I find generally just a tremendous fear of evangelism. And the number one question I get, usually we'll do a Q&A. If we have time, we'll try to do a Q&A tomorrow after the lecture portion too. But the number one question that I get asked from people when I go places is, what's the first thing that you say to someone? What do you say first? Kind of freeze up at the thought of sharing the gospel, and we're looking for a way to get started. And what we're really looking for is some kind of a mechanistic approach. Just tell me, these 10 things. I'm going to say these 10 things, and then they're just going to jump in the baptistry. We're looking for something kind of simple. So what I want to do is share with you some thoughts around this about what the starting point really for evangelism is. And here in 1 Peter 3:15, the starting point here, in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. This is the starting point. Jesus told us that where our treasure is, that's where our heart is. So the starting point, if we want to do evangelism, is here. It's in our hearts. We've got to get that in our hearts because that's where we generate passion. And I'm convinced that the reason, for the most part, that we don't do evangelism is because we're lacking passion. And we're going to talk about that. Our hearts generate a passion, and this should be self-evidence to us. And the other thing is, we really already know how to talk to strangers. I bet if I ask right now, how many of you talked to a stranger today, I'll bet most of you would raise your hand about something. We'll talk to strangers about anything. You know, we do this all the time. We'll talk to strangers about the weather or health and safety. I might not ought to bring this one up, but couponing and, you know, we're more excited about tires being on sale at Walmart. And we're happy to tell a stranger about that because we know they want to hear about it. But in some cases, it's stuff we want them to hear about. Have you ever had a political discussion with somebody? Well, that's the colors are all messed up. But have you ever had a discussion about politics with a complete stranger? Well, sure you have. We will talk with people about things that we're passionate about. Some of you may know that I'm from this state that tends to be a little passionate about football. You know, and you know how you can tell? Because they're all wearing Alabama jerseys and hats, and they're just wanting you to talk about it. And just to be on the safe side, I have to bring in Auburn on this because they won one. So the atmosphere there is a little charged. But that doesn't happen here, does it? I mean, no, you don't have anything here that would, you know, bring up any discussion. I sat there last night at dinner with Andrew and Robert, and I thought they were just going to get into a fight over whether A&M was going to have the number one draft pick or not. We're passionate about that stuff. We'll wear the jerseys. We want to let people know this is who I'm following. This is what I'm passionate about. And this is the last thing I've got to say on it right here, is that if you're not convinced, you ever seen a license plate like this? If you sit next to a grandparent, what's going to happen before you leave? What are they going to do? You're going to be looking at the pictures of the grandchildren, aren't you? That's what grandparents do. They're going to make sure that you see their grandchildren. Oh, by the way, this is my grandchildren right here. This is Landon and Caroline and Coleman. And is Coleman here tonight? Yeah, back there somewhere. My daughter is here, and Coleman, if you want to see just one of the cutest fellows in the world, he's here with us tonight. But we'll do that. Why? Because we're passionate about our grandchildren. We're passionate. And the point is that we know how to do this. But we need to use common sense, too. Some grandparents will just tackle you. Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how to respond to each person. The gospel, it's not a message that we need to tackle people in the supermarket and force them to hear it, but let's just be good citizens. Let's just use common sense. Let's build up a rapport with somebody, and if we got any kind of rapport with them at all, let's find a way to try to talk to them about what's really the most important thing in our lives and what we're passionate about. And somebody said this, some wise person said this, if the fire is there, the methods will take care of themselves. So that's really all I'm saying about it, is that if the passion is there, we will find, we know how to do it, every one of us. We know how to do it already. We know how to bring up topics and subjects to people. Now, you might do some further study on that. There may be some people here that are just experts in communications and can help refine a method or process for talking to people. But at the end of the day, all I'm saying is, if we're passionate about something, we already know how to do this. So where is our passion? Why don't we have more passion for the gospel. I want to explore that with you, a few things that I'm observing. And the first is that a lot of us that kind of grew up in the church, you know, we just kind of grew up and did what we were expected to do, and it really wasn't a passionate thing at all. And I believe that if we've misunderstood or not fully grasped God's mercy, then we really don't, I mean, God's justice. If we've never really understood his justice, then his mercy just might not mean that much to us. But I always think of this too, that think of this, if we said here, okay, we're going to start giving out $1,000 cash for every convert, would that change our thoughts about sharing the gospel? What if we said, we're going to give you $50 for every person you share the gospel with? Would that change our thinking about, well, maybe I'll do this? So if you grasp that thought, I mean, it really is a motivational issue, because all of us could use a little extra income. But if the passion is there, we'll see the value in that, and it won't be something there. And the other thing is that perhaps we don't have a love for the lost. I see passages like Luke 15. What man among you, if he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one who's lost until he finds it? When he's found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. This was the example that the Lord gave us to explain how much he loves us, that he would be willing to do that. And have we developed the same kind of love for the lost that the Lord had for us? We were the one. We were the one in that parable that he's talking about. What about this idea here? We must develop a sympathy for people and a realization that they are dead forever without the gospel. Ephesians 2:13, you were dead in your trespasses and sins in which you formerly walked according to the course of the world. People that haven't heard the gospel, that haven't responded to the gospel, are dead people. It kind of reminds me of that movie, The Sixth Sense, the little boy that says, you know, I see these dead people. They're walking around like regular people. They don't know they're dead. And they need my help. I travel a lot. And it vexes me to go through the Atlanta airport. You just sit. And I don't know if you've ever done that, but there's just thousands of people just rushing this way and that way, just going to get this. And all I'm sitting there thinking is, dead men walking. Oh, that I could share the gospel with all these people. If there was some way to do that. Do you see dead people? Do you care? This passage in Exodus where Moses went back to the Lord and said, what a great sin these people have committed. They've made themselves gods of gold, but now, if you will, forgive their sin. And if not, blot me out of your book from which you've written. How can he say that? I mean, I'm nowhere near this point. But look what Paul said. Romans 9:3, I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart, for I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. He was saying, I'm willing to sacrifice my soul, Lord, if you would save my brethren over here. I'm just astounded by that. I couldn't do that. I don't know how Paul could say that. But here we are. What are we willing to sacrifice to try to save people? Would we be willing to give up that extra boat or car or vacation home or cable TV? Would we be willing to sacrifice anything to try to save others? Certainly not our soul. Another thing I think I run into a lot is people think they don't know enough. Before I can share the gospel with somebody, I need to know a lot of stuff. But I want you to look at what Paul said. He said this in 1 Corinthians 2:1. He said, "And when I came to you, brethren, I did not come to you with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God, for I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified." You know what he said? What he's saying there? He said, "All I knew when I came to you was the gospel." Because that's what the gospel is. Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And you don't have to have a PhD or a college education to teach the gospel to somebody. God could have made it so that only rocket scientists could teach the gospel or believe it or understand it. Instead, what he did was he made it so that it was so clear and simple that even a child could understand. And it took me a long time to appreciate what Paul was saying there. But another thing is, maybe we're just afraid of rejection. Our culture is changing, and all of those of us that went to FC back in the 70s realize what a sea change has happened in this last generation. We are going to be a generation, probably the first one, where we start really in this country suffering persecution. It's already becoming politically incorrect to be a believer. If you've not seen Richard Dawkins going on the offensive, just yesterday or day before, Richard Dawkins said that it was child abuse for a parent to take a child to church and teach them about God. That's what we're running up against. Now, are you going to be willing to go out and share the gospel in that environment if you haven't been doing it in an easier one? Maybe we're afraid to be politically incorrect. But that's where it's headed. But Jesus told us, "Therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father in heaven. But I will deny, whoever denies me before men, I will deny him before my Father in heaven." Jesus knew that it may cost us something to be a Christian and to profess our faith. And he's willing to tell us that that counts for something. It counts for something when we put ourselves on the line to profess him, but it also counts for nothing when we refuse to do it. In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks. So there is some preparation required. I think about rock climbing, something you'll never find me doing. But you don't just sit there one day and say, I think I'll be a rock climber, and just go out and start scaling mountains. You have to work at that. And you have to practice at that. And you have to spend a lot of time preparing for that. We lived in the Netherlands, which is flatter than Houston, if you can imagine that. And I would go to the metro, and they had built a wall there where you could go underground. And that was like one of the highest things around. And guys would be sitting there practicing rock climbing on that wall, because if they fell, it would only be about a 1 foot fall. But they practiced. They were willing to prepare to win. You talk about Alabama and football championship. And yes, I'm aware that Texas A&M is the only team that beat Alabama last year. And frankly, I could care less. But anyway, that's just for the record, I do know that. But we have to do our homework. We need to study materials and backgrounds and work with other Christians and learn the things. It's not just wanting to do something, but it's developing the will to do it. These college teams, they don't just want to win national championships. They just work themselves to a frenzy and all to try to accomplish those things. And we need to have that attitude to prepare ourselves to do the kind of things that we need to do. And we need to develop an interest. One of the reasons I don't think we do, we're just not interested in it. you know, I remember hearing a teacher telling once about how difficult it was to get their 6-year-olds or 7-year-olds, I can't remember, those small kids, to learn the books of the Old Testament because they were so hard. And then I ran into this thing called Pokemon. And I don't know if you know these are Japanese characters, and there's hundreds of these things, and they all got 50-cent names, and they're all Japanese, and these kids could tell you every one of them on this chart by name, knew them by heart. The difference was they were interested in this, but the books of the Old Testament just weren't all that interesting. Now, the adult version of this is fantasy football. I know men that, oh, man, they can tell you every statistic about every player and every football team or baseball team, but they couldn't string 5 passages together to tell someone how to respond to the God of the universe and his plan of redemption. So we have the same problem, and that goes for baseball too, just to be safe, no pun intended. But we can learn anything that our heart purposes for us. So we have to find a way to develop a passion for what we really want to do. And it wouldn't hurt us to practice. You know, if we really want to be evangelistic, let's study together. Let's role play. Let's try to build our confidence and do the things that we need to do. Then he says, be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you. Well, this is the third point. Why would anybody ask us what we believe? Why would that be important to anyone? I remember an old Irish preacher said once that there's really 5 gospels. There's Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and you. People look at our lives, and if we're not walking the walk, why would anybody ask us to give a reason for what we believe? You know, I've had people, you know, being an executive in information technology, and I've run businesses, I've been a chief information officer and all that, but I'll oftentimes get comments from the other executives, and it's like, Ken, why don't you ever lie about anything? You know, because it just makes it so much easier. You know, you could just lie about this, and you wouldn't have to worry about it. You know, any of the problems that we have. And I would then try to use that as an opportunity. So give me an hour and let me explain. I'll explain to you why I don't lie about things. And I'll tell you a story about that tomorrow if you'll remind me. You're the only Bible the world will ever know. We sing that song, but we've got to really realize that. And finally, be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks to give the reason for the hope that you have. And that's really why I'm here. Because the hope that we have comes from the gospel. If indeed you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard. The gospel is our hope. The gospel is the path to salvation. It's where the power of God is to salvation. We keep coming back to this passage, and we'll keep coming back to this passage. And it only took me about 25 years of coming back to this passage until I realized that the gospel is where the power is. Not in all these other myriad of things that we've been trying. So how do we convert people? Well, basically, in my travels and everything, essentially, we have one method. One and only one that I have encountered thus far. And that is the Bible study. We want to get people and invite them to a Bible study. We want to get them into a Bible study. And this typically takes about 3 months, generally. And it's generally we study, we want to get them to, we generally do this to believers to start with, and we then start into Bible authority and move them through all that. And if everything goes well after 3 months, then we'll let them be baptized. But I want to show you something. I want to just notice something. You may have seen this chart before, and I don't know why the colors are off. This is the only thing we didn't test last night. But you may have seen this chart before showing examples of conversion in the New Testament, all these different ones. We had Jews and non-Jews, proselytes, Gentiles, people that were worshipers, pagans. And how do we normally use this chart? Well, we normally use it to show that, look, each one of these people were baptized. You ever seen that before? It's pretty much a classic chart. But I want you to bring something else to your attention. Every one of these took place in one session. Let me let that sink in. They didn't have a three-month Bible study. In one session, these people were presented the gospel, and they responded to it. That's all I'm saying. All I'm saying here today, tonight, is that we can do this. We can do this too. Now, I've had people classify my, whatever you want to call it, approach as, Ken Craig's got this approach where you can convert people in an hour or one session, you know. No, that's not what I have. That's not what I do. Here's what I have. I contend that any one of us in here can share the gospel with somebody in one session. That's what you can do. I know we can do that because we have ample examples of that being done. So that's what we'll talk more about. And I want to bring up a good example, an illustration of this that Christ gave us in the parable of the sower. You remember the parable of the sower, right? I should have taken that energy drink. Luke. Somebody got it? Verse 5. I'll think of it. It'll pop in a second. But the sower goes out to sow. And it came to pass as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured it. Some fell on stony ground, where it had not much earth. And immediately it sprang up because it had no depth of earth. When the sun came up, it was scorched and it withered away. Some fell among the thorns, grew up, and the thorns choked it, and then some fell in the good soil. Now, what's interesting about this to me is if you look at this, that in three out of the four places that the seed was sown, it produced no results. Only in one place did it produce results. And I think this is an interesting parable that the Lord gave us. Because what is the seed? It's the Word of God. It's the gospel. We're sowing that out there. I said maybe this should be called the parable or the story of the stupid gardener. You know, I don't know how many of you garden, but do you just take a bunch of seed and go out and just throw it? Don't you first? You know, we would go and say, wait a minute, that's rocky soil over there, and that's stone, that's thorny, and here I need to get this looks like good soil, I'm going to go work that up, and then and after I get all that done, I'll throw the seed out. Was that what he was doing? No, he's just sowing. And it tells me that this is what God has asked us to do. We're to be sowers of the seed. And let him worry about the soil. Let him worry about the ground. It's falling on. Our job is just to get it out there. Sow the seed. That's our objective. But what happens with us is we want results. We want results. We want our own results. So we become soil inspectors. We're going to first check that soil, and we're going to decide whether this soil is not too rocky and it's not too thorny and it's just right. And this person over here with these tattoos, I know that's rocky soil. They're not going to want to hear this. But this religious person over here, well, they're already a believer, so maybe I can get somewhere with them. We become soil inspectors because we want results. And then the other thing is that we become soil preparers. You know, it's not enough just to find some good soil, but I want to get that soil right where I want it to be. I'm going to work that soil and work that soil. It takes about 3 months. And then when I get everything just right, I'm going to pop the seed in there, see what happens then. What I'm trying to learn myself and convince others of is that every time you sow the seed, you are successful. Our success is not measured by how many conversions we're getting or what kind of numbers we're getting. Our success is based upon sowing the seed. God asked us to be sowers. I don't know any place in the New Testament where he said, now, every one of you, by the time you're 50 years, if you've been a Christian for 10 years, you should have converted this many people. I don't see anything like that in the Scriptures. But I see things like this that say we need to be out sowing the seed. I don't believe God's going to hold us accountable for how many people we've converted on the Day of Judgment. But I believe we just might be held accountable for whether we've been sowing the seed or not. Because that's what we should be about. We should be the most seed-sowing people there are. We need to be creating cultures of seed-sowing. Another word for evangelism. We need to be creating cultures for doing this. So what approach should I take? Now, here's what I'm seeing some of the current approaches are, because we got to get these numbers up. And one is that, we should take our church buildings and our Bible classes and our worship, and we should turn these into evangelistic tools. And the idea is that when a visitor comes to you, your evangelism process now is essentially one of going and inviting people to come to your church. That's all you have to do now. You just invite them to church, because surely you can do that. And then when they come to church, the visitor comes in, you shoot off a confetti cannon, and you just make this the best experience they've ever had. And you make those classes so exciting that the kids will want to bring their parents back for the classes. And all of this now becomes not something for us to use to edify and encourage and strengthen those of us that are out battling all week, but now it becomes what we try to use to attract people. Your services now are visitor-centric services. This is the model. This is modeled after the approach that the mega churches are using, the evangelicals, to create these mega churches. And even they're beginning to react to this. This is a quote by one of them. Churches' adoption of marketing fads will actually hurt in the long run. Mega churches are the triumph of the generic. By copying their approach, mainline Protestant churches are speeding their own numerical decline. Mega churches have found an innovation in marketing, but these things can go up in smoke in a minute. And I've got a clip, an audio clip here, if it works, from Gary Henry, where he addressed this in one of his lessons, and it was so good because he can say it so much better than I can. Let's see if this will play. Not playing. I'll go back and see if they want to. Try it again. All right. It worked last night. Nope. may just have to abandon Gary Henry. No, I got this. Tell Jonathan, that's why I told him he should be here tonight. All right, well, okay. Well, I'll just tell you what he said. What Gary said essentially is that these approaches of using our churches and everything as a market is that what we're essentially saying to people is, come be with us. It'll be seamless. You'll just love it here. You're just like one of us. And he's making the point that that was so far away from first century evangelism. To be incredible, that it was you either accepted the gospel or not, and it made you very different, and it not always wasn't a comfortable environment. And he says it much better than I did. But here's my question. Are we painting the pig? I mean, what are we doing? You know, again, we're trying to take things that weren't intended for these purposes and use them that way. And so we see, you know, you can look out there and you can just see tons of stuff being used to try to attract people to church. We got to get them to church. We got to get our numbers up because that's what our objective is. That's what validates us, is numbers. And anything that'll accomplish that is fair game. And somewhere in the back, there's the gospel just kind of hanging back here by itself. And some other wise person said this: what we attract people with is what they are converted to. If we try to attract people with our church, that's what they're going to be converted to. Is that what we're trying to do? Are we trying to convert people to the church? Or are we trying to convert people to Jesus Christ? What do we attract people with? Our buildings? Singing? You know, certainly if we have visitors come, we don't want them to think we're crazy lunatics. But I find that people that come to our services, that is just throwing obstacles in the way of the gospel. Because they don't want to hear about the gospel. They want to be saying, well, why don't you have women doing this? And what's all this stuff here? And why aren't you singing with instrumental? Now they want to discuss all that stuff, and they haven't even heard the gospel message. Or do we attract people with the only thing that has any real power to convert them? What is that? The gospel. That is the power of God unto salvation. The gospel's the bait. Nothing more, nothing less. Now, you know, this is what I find, is that we're all looking for some kind of magic bullet. Well, if there is such a thing, it's only one thing, and that's the gospel. Because that's the only thing that has any real power to convert anyone. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't use a lot of other things to get people in the building and get these seats filled up. But the gospel is the only thing that is the power to salvation. And let me just make this clear. What I'm saying is the gospel is not our church buildings. It's not whether we use instrumental music or not. It's not even baptism. That's not the gospel. And it's not what we do with our money. Now, these are all very, very important things, and they have their place in things, but that's not the gospel message. That is what the apostles used to try to convert people with to Jesus Christ. The power is in the message, just like we read earlier. It's not in our skill, our ability. It's not in our cleverness. It's not in our attractiveness. And I want you to really think about that. If the gospel can be shared with someone really fairly simply and fairly easily in a fairly short time, isn't that kind of empowering? Wouldn't you feel kind of empowered to do that? But no, the gospel needs our help. We need gospel helper. because we want results. And here's what I've concluded, is that we need to, when we're not getting the results that we want, when we start focusing on results, it gets us in trouble every time. And I believe we can look even historically at a lot of things that have gone on, and that's what it's all about. We have decided, look at the Galatians. What were they doing? When Paul said, you're teaching a different gospel and you're going to be condemned for it. What were they doing? Were they mean people? They were just trying to help. We can convert more of our Jewish brethren if we just change this little thing right here and ask them to be circumcised. We're not doing this out of bad intent. We're just trying to get the numbers up. And it's just the siren song. I want to suggest a few things to you, that what trouble we get into when we start trying to get the numbers up is that first we decide, well, we're going to help the gospel. We're going to make it more attractive. And that's what we were talking about a few minutes ago, the social gospel. We'll use all these things to try to attract people, and that will get the numbers up. But what happens when that's not working like we need it to? Well, here's what we can do. Here's another great idea. Let's institutionalize the church. We'll get a bunch of churches together, and we'll all send money over to this eldership over here, and they'll take care of getting the work done, and we'll be able to get more conversions that way. But I can tell you this. I used to didn't see any real danger in this. This was just like some piddly doctrinal quibble kind of a thing till I started traveling internationally working with churches. And let me tell you, what's on the other side of this is so ugly, you wouldn't believe it. Now, I'm violently opposed to this stuff. Because what you get on the other side is you get these churches in these other countries become boss churches. And the preachers become boss churches. And they control the money and they control the buildings. And they decide who can preach and who can't preach. And it's just pure denominationalism. It's just functional denomination. Now, technically, it may not be, but it sure functions that way, and it's the ugliest thing you've ever seen when you're in these other countries and seeing preachers that are getting fired and all this just over because of this boss preacher over here, this boss church over here. So we decide we'll institutionalize it, but now that's not working. So what do we do now? Well, we just need to change it. This hermeneutic just isn't working. We need a new hermeneutic. And all that means is a fancy way of saying how we apply the scriptures. So we need a, you know, what's hurting us? Well, we need a hermeneutic that gets rid of all of our traditions. You know, we need a hermeneutic now that'll let women participate in, and that'll allow music. And all the, our old hermeneutic is keeping people away. We can't become a mega church with that old hermeneutic. We need to change it. So we'll help the gospel in that way. Now, what happens when even that's not working? Well, here's what we do. Is we just abandon it. We just quit using the gospel entirely. And within our fellowship, whatever that is, we can't really convert religious people much anymore because postmodernism says, well, it doesn't really matter what you believe anymore. What's good for you, what's true for you may not be true for me. So what we do, one thing we do, because we're not going to go out and teach the gospel, is we become heresy detectors. And that is, here's Jeff over here. Now, I don't know Jeff. Seemed like a nice guy. I've heard good things about him, but I can guarantee you, if I put him under a microscope and I look at him close enough, I am going to find heresy right there. And I'm going to ferret that out, and I'm going to publish it, and Jeff's going to get in trouble, and I have accomplished something for the kingdom. Now, what I'm not doing is sharing the gospel with anybody, but I'm doing something to be productive because I'm going to ferret out heresy. So this is one side of this coin. This is what I call the gospel hammer. That's an old saying. It said, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that sort of, to me, is reflective of this sense or attitude that I find here. But now what happens is we've seen that. And I'd say most of us here have seen it. And we realize how ugly that is and how hateful it is. And we don't want to be part of that, do we? Is that us? We don't want to be like that. So what do? We swing the other way. We decide, well, I can't do this, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to become a perfect worshiper. I'm going to get rid of all these old traditions and everything that these hammers were using, and I'm not going to be a hammer, so I'm going to reject everything they were doing. But I'm going to be so much more spiritual than them, and I'm going to be a much better worshiper. And don't you stay in these old congregations and worship these old traditional ways. You need to come over here because we're worshiping. We're spiritual, not like those guys. You remember 1 Corinthians 12? This teaching about if the eye is not a hand, is not a foot, it's not a nose. We're all here with our different gifts and all, and we need to work together and never say, I have no need of you. But here's what I see is that we got all the noses, and they said, hey, we're not having any fun here. Let's go over here and start our own church of the noses. And we'll just pull all the noses out of all the other churches, and we'll have just the most harmonious nose worship you've ever seen. And it'll be great and wonderful. And the only problem is the noses are all stuck up in the air. I was talking with a friend of mine about this last week, and I put this chart in after we talked. Dan DeGarmo, I don't know if y'all know him or not. Great fellow, great friend of mine. But I looked at it this way, is that we've got the Bible, and if we look at this pendulum, where Jesus said the true worshiper of God will worship in spirit and truth. And we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but when you look at what the New Testament teachings are, spirit is not a higher principle than truth, and truth is not a higher principle than spirit. Achieving that balance is our challenge. And when we swing over to the right and we just focus on the truth, the truth, the truth, the truth, the truth, we become doctrinal Pharisees. And when we go, and so our reaction to that is to swing over to the other side and we'll start focusing on the Spirit, that's all that matters, and Spirit is what it's all about, and don't worry about this whole hermeneutic stuff and authority and all that, it's just all Spirit. And the point is this, Phariseeism is lurking in either extreme. And I'll tell you what's not happening here. Or here is no one is out there sharing the gospel. These are the tactics that we're employing to avoid that so we can still be productive in the kingdom. We need a faith-based approach, faith in the gospel, rather than a results or a methods-focused approach. And yes, we may have to kill some of our own sacred cows to do that. And I'm not even going to go into that one. I should have probably just skipped right over that slide. But I want to move on to the next point. And that, look at this last thing. I didn't read this earlier in 1 Peter 3:15. In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Prepare to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and reverence. When we are giving this gospel to people, how are we to do it? That's important. We're told how to do that. Gentleness towards whom? Who are we to be gentle toward? The person we're presenting to. Reverence towards whom? Towards God. When we share the gospel, it should be on the basis of that right there. We never have to go at someone to share the gospel with a hammer in a condemnatory attitude or a haughty spirit. Gently do this with reverence to God. And you see a lot of passages in the New Testament that really describe this attitude. 2 Timothy, don't have anything to do with any foolish and stupid arguments because you know they produce quarrels. The Lord's servant must not quarrel. Instead, he must be kind to everyone, able to teach and not resentful. Those who oppose him, he must gently instruct in the hope that God will grant them repentance, leading them to a knowledge of the truth. They will come to their senses, escape from the trap of the devil who has taken them captive to do his will. The attitude that we have is as important as anything else we're doing in evangelism. It's not about conquest or ego or arrogance or who knows the most Greek. You don't even need to understand Greek to share the gospel with someone. I know it's a shock. And a Pharisaic attitude will not convert many, if any. So to summarize, to become an effective sower, I say there's three components that I would propose here that sort of encapsulate this. First, we need to have passion. We need to have the right attitude of gentleness and reverence, and we need to know the gospel. And it's these three components. This is really the sort of the three-legged stool, if you will, of evangelism. So when you consider this, so what's going to happen if we're missing passion? We may know the gospel and we may have a great attitude, but if we don't have passion, we're not going to be out there sowing, are we? Even though we know the gospel, even though we've got a great attitude, we're just not going to sow. But what if we've got passion? And what if we really do know the gospel, but we don't have the attitude part? Well, if we're missing attitude, then when we sow, we're going to beat people up. It's going to be ugly if we don't have that attitude of gentleness and reverence. And what if we've got passion and we've got the right attitude? If we don't know the gospel, then what we're going to do is we're going to burn out. We're either going to burn out. I use the analogy of trying to cut wood using the back of the axe. We'll burn out. Or we'll teach a different gospel, which is definitely going to get us condemned if we do that. Or we'll maybe focus on church growth tactics. We'll have to do stuff like that. We'll have to do other things because we're not using the gospel. Now we need all three of these components. Now I want to share something with you. This will be the last thing before I realize I'm a little bit over, but that was because we couldn't get the Gary Henry clip playing, which was awesome. Maybe I'll play it tomorrow for you. But in my career, I've done for several years. I was a executive management consultant in information technology, and I would go into a company a lot of times, and they'd have problems. That's why they called me, and I'd have to try to troubleshoot what was wrong and try to figure out what was happening. And I used this little method. It was developed at Harvard some years ago, and it was called a maturity assessment. It's real simple. What you do is you go into a company, and you look at their different functions, accounting, operations, sales, marketing, whatever it was. You just list all those down. And then you'd look at their environment and you'd define a maturity level for each of those functions. And the maturity would start at a 1, which was the least mature position you could be, all the way up to a 5, where it was perfect. And we'd develop this grid, and then we'd go through and we'd look at each function and we'd make an assessment. Well, where do they stand on this? Oh, they're not very mature on this one. We'd click it there, and oh, they're pretty good on this, they're terrible on this. And when we get through, we could kind of get a feel for where all the problems were, and then we'd develop a strategic plan to work on those. See, you can all be consultants now. Piece of cake. Well, I was sitting there one night, and it just struck me, what would this look like for evangelism? If I were going to sit down with you and rate you on a scale of 1 to 5, where would you fit on this? So this is totally non-inspired opinion, but it might be of interest to you. And you might have some thoughts you can help me to refine this, but I call this the 5 stages of evangelistic maturity. Stage 1, I call this avoidance. And in this stage, we never share the gospel with anyone. In fact, we want to let others do it. If the subject comes up, retreat. I'm unprepared and I'm unwilling to share the gospel. And by the way, that's what my money is for. That's why I give my money for. Stage 2, I call it reluctance. Now here, I may occasionally discuss religion with someone. But they have to bring it up. And it's usually only when I'm backed into a corner and I'm really not very prepared. By the way, that's what my preacher's for. That's what he's supposed to be doing. Now, stage 3, I call this equipped. Now, here, I'll occasionally share the gospel with someone, but I need a push from someone else. I've spent some time in preparation, but I prefer to assist someone else, and I'm still quite afraid of rejection. By the way, that's what our church should be doing. Stage 4, I'm now confident. And here I'm ready and I'm willing and I'm able to share the gospel with anyone. And I'll go for it when the opportunity presents itself. And I've spent some significant time in preparation. I'm comfortable with the message, but I'm maybe lacking somewhat in zeal, but I'm often motivated by guilt. Stage 5 is what I call the committed stage. Now here, I'm going to actively pursue sharing the gospel with anyone, anytime, anywhere. I'm passionate and I'm consumed with the mission to sow the seed. I actively seek opportunities to share the gospel. I encourage and try to help others. And here's why. I'm motivated by joy. If I can get one message across to you tonight, what I'm trying to get you to understand, I've been to congregations, and I've sat in congregations where preachers come in to talk about evangelism, and they just beat you to death. And they make you feel so guilty. Why aren't you out there doing this? You need to be doing this, and you don't love the Lord if you're not doing it. And you just finish, and you're just beat to death. We're trying to motivate ourselves with guilt. I want to tell you, it's a whole different world if we can be motivated by joy. And I hope that we can try to get there. I wasn't always there. I was a hammer. I never opened my Bible or used my Bible with anyone else unless it was to beat them over the head with it. But there's a joy in sharing the gospel. And that's what I want to convince you about tonight. That's the target we need to try to be at. That's our objective. That's what the Lord has asked us to do. That's what He's called us to do, is to just have so much passion about this message, about what Jesus Christ has done for us, that we couldn't help but share it with people. I mean, I know a friend of mine. He goes to the grocery store, and when he's getting ready to check out, he'll find the longest line at the checkout. You know why? Because he wants to try to start a conversation with that person that's in front of him in line so that he can maybe can get to some point where they'll let him talk with them about the gospel. That's a wonderful way to do it. And you're not tackling anybody. You're just, it should just be an expression of our passion for what the Lord has done for us. Everyone deserves the opportunity to either accept or reject the gospel. Where are people going to hear the gospel? Where are they going to hear it? On TV? In the paper? The best chance anyone around here has to hear the gospel is from this group right here. We know it. And we're just going to keep it bottled up. You can do it. Every Christian can do this. We need to just get it. Get some passion in our heart. Generate some passion and zeal. Learn it. Know the gospel. Know what it is. And practice sharing it with others. Develop a love for the lost. That's part of that attitude that we got to have. Teach the gospel message to others with gentleness and reverence, and then live it. Let others see our service, our joy, and our passion for what God has done for us. That's all I have for tonight. Tomorrow morning, what time do we start? 9 o'clock. If you're going to come for the lectures in the morning and the workshop part of this, try to be here at 9, because the material is cumulative. And, you know, whereas I can do this with a non-Christian in about 15 minutes to a half an hour, with Christians, it takes a little longer. Okay. So I'll put a little more information in there that hopefully will help you to grasp the significance of this simple, simple message. Thank you for your time tonight. I really appreciate it. I know you didn't have anything else to do on a Friday night, and I hope this has been encouraging to you, and we'll look forward to hopefully seeing you tomorrow morning, where we can spend some more time with you. God bless you all. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you, Ken, for those good words, and you're provoking our perspective on evangelism this evening. Hope that you have been benefited by this. I know that I have, and appreciate Ken's investment in us. Thank you for being here this evening. Appreciate your investing your time and your attention, and things that matter, a crucial part of our identity as Christians, and so we are thankful to you as well for your sharing this work and this passion. For getting the word, the good news about what God's done in your life out to other people. As we just mentioned, tomorrow morning, if somebody asks you a reason for where you're going and what time it is, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, 9 to 11:30 is what we're planning on about tomorrow, but we'll get started at 9 o'clock. And so in about 12 hours, there's a happy thought. In about 12 hours, we'll be right back here at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And then again, do remember Sunday, the Bible class hour, 9 o'clock, worship 10, and then 5 p.m. Sunday evening. Those three sessions on Sunday, Brother Craig will be walking through the big picture of the Bible. And if you haven't already invited somebody you know who you would like to hear the big picture of the Bible, it's not too late to do that. Talk to somebody, your friend, your family member, your coworker, your neighbor, whoever it may be, and bring them with you on Sunday, and we'll look forward to that. Good to be together tonight. I'll ask you to bow with me, and we'll end in a word of prayer. Our good Father in heaven, we are truly in shock and awe over your mercy and your grace to us, that you have shown us such favor, and that despite our sinfulness and our rebellion, not only have you forgiven us, but the way in which you've forgiven us is to take our punishment and our penalty upon yourself. In Jesus of Nazareth, Father, may we learn to live lives of joy on the basis of your great gift. And above all, Father, may it be a selfless joy, a joy that motivates us to want others to know about the gift that we receive and that we revel in. May this motivate us, Father. May this joy reshape our hearts and give us both the passion and the courage to tell a world that's dying about who you are, who you really are, and what you've done. on our behalf. Be with us this evening as we go our separate ways. Be your will, the world's still here and we're still in it. May we gather together tomorrow morning to enjoy each other's fellowship and above all to consider together how better to do your work as Christians, as this church, and shine light in the world. Thank you for Jesus. It's in his name we offer this prayer. Amen.